Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now commencing in this audio to begin the study of the book of Judges. I'm going to take up the first 20 verses of Judges chapter 1. I will call it Judah's Conquest. Before I begin, let me give you some introduction to the book. I'm going to pull this from the famous 19th century theologian and Bible scholar Farrar. Maybe not theologian, but Bible scholar Farrar. I pull this from Ellicott's commentary. First of all, what is the definition of judges? The Hebrew is shofatim. Well, a good definition would be a deliverer. A deliverer, namely a deliverer from foreign oppression, is what a judge is. He's not a civil ruler. A judge is a national hero rather than a civil or religious guide. He's not a judicial officer, even though the English translation makes him sound like that, a judge. He's not a judge. He's a deliverer from foreign oppression. What's the plan of the book of Judges? Is it arranged chronologically? No, it's not. The appendices actually refer to an earlier judge than judge number 12, the 12 judges in the book. Is the plan geographical? No, we have judges that come from the north, east, south, and west in no particular order. There are five sections of the book. Section 1 is the general introduction from Judges 1:1 to Judges 2:5. Section 1 gives a sketch of the imperfect conquest of the land previous to the death of Joshua to show the want of obedience, which was the cause of all subsequent troubles. And this section is entirely retrospective. It's a repeat of what happened in Joshua. Section 2 is what Farrar calls the second introduction, Judges 2:6 to Judges 3:6. This is to show the spiritual neglect on the part of the Israelites that has led to deep religious degeneracy, but nonetheless, God has not forgotten his people. Section 3 is the main section of the book, the story of 12 judges. That goes from Judges 3:7 to Judges 16:31. Six of the judges have their story told in detail. Six are merely alluded to. Then we go to Section 4. That's the first appendix. This is in Judges 17 and 18, the three incidents described there, Micah's idolatry, the story of Jonathan, the grandson of Moses, and three, the conquest of Laish by the Danites. And then we go to Appendix 2, which is Section 5 of the book. This is in Judges 19, where Benjamin is almost extirpated by their fellow Israelites. The author of the book, well, the author is more of a compiler than an author. He used documents as well as oral tradition, as Colin Delitzsch pointed out. There was a different author of the preface and appendices. That author of the preface and appendices was the same author, most probably. And then the author of the main section was a different author. This is determined by style, which I realize can be a little bit dicey. This is according to Farrar. An interesting little side comment here. The book of Ruth was originally a part of the book of Judges, but in AD 450, Ruth was removed to become a book of her own. Now, what is the date of the book? GotQuestions.org says it's probably between 1045 and 1000 B.C. Farrar has it during Saul's reign, which is roughly 1052 to 1010, although Saul's dates are controverted. I'm using dates here from the Interactive Bible. But roughly in that area, Saul's time. And by the way, nobody knows who the author is. Here's a summary of the book. This is from Farrar. The whole book may be regarded as an historical comment on the promises and threatenings of the book of Deuteronomy, like the blessings and curses of Deuteronomy 27:28. Here's another statement from Farrar. But when we look from the general lessons to the special deeds, even of heroes who were summoned by God's calling to the work of deliverance, we see abundant traces of the imperfection of that moral enlightenment which God vouchsafed to the chosen people only by slow degrees as the result of every deepening experiences. Both in its pathos and its passion, the book is intensely human, and its heroes are the children of their own day, alike in their wrath and their tenderness, their laxity and their superstition. It must be now clear to every Christian that the exterminating wars of Joshua, the fearful and indiscriminate vengeance inflicted by Israel on the offending tribe of Benjamin, the treachery of Ehud and of Jael, the wild revenge of Samson, the blood vengeance of Gideon, and other events herein narrated are not to be quoted as examples from modern times. They are entirely alien to the whole drift of all that is best and highest in the moral teaching even of the Old Testament scriptures, and still more alien to all the teachings of Christ. The view which we take of these actions will be found in the notes, and it will be seen that while no attempt is made to gild with imaginary sanctioned deeds which in themselves were due to times of ignorance and the passions of men on whose minds the full light had not yet dawned, yet on the other hand, the faith and the courage by which these old heroes were animated received their full recognition, and they are judged solely by the standard prevalent in their own age and country. Now, that's an interesting quotation to me because I love how these people today are saying, oh, you know, George Washington believed in slavery. He was a monster. Thomas Jefferson owned slaves. He was a monster. These woke fools that are now running all over America in the corporations, the military, the sports networks. They're idiots. And one day in a future age, people are going to judge them by the standards of their age instead of by the standards of ours. We've got to leave room for the leavening effect of Christianity through the ages. And besides, just because an historical book records a horrible bloodthirsty deed doesn't mean that God sanctioned it. It just said, hey, this is what happened. Now, if those deeds were sanctioned, for example, in the New Testament, in the book of Hebrews, the Hebrews heroes of faith, it's because they were fighting for God according to the standards of their time. Plus, you're talking about a military situation here, folks. War is hell. And obviously, we're not going to sanction in the church military actions. But these people were not in the church. They were trying to keep a group of people alive militarily, and sometimes you've got to be rough to do that. Otherwise, you're going to die. All right, so now with that introduction, let's start with verses 1 and 3. Now, it came about after the death of Joshua that the sons of Israel inquired of the Lord, saying, who shall go up first for us against the Canaanites to fight against them? The Lord said, Judah shall go up. Behold, I have given the land into his hand. Then Judah said to Simeon, his brother, come up with me into the territory allotted me, that we may fight against the Canaanites, and I in turn will go with you into the territory allotted you. So Simeon went with him. Now this, of course, is after the death of Joshua, and this is going to introduce a problem because a lot of what we're going to read here in Judges 1 happened already before the death of Joshua. I'm assuming here that Judah and Simeon did do this after the death of Joshua, but then the author or the compiler just mentioned some other things that were done earlier during the book of Joshua, where Judah was conquered, the land of Judah, the allotment of Judah was conquered by Judah. So there's some retrospective here as well as prospective. Now, how long after the death of Joshua did this movement by Judah take place? How long after? We cannot tell, as Adam Clark says. Probably not very long, as Clark also says. Now for some dates here. BibleHub.com has Joshua dying about 1375 B.C., and the book of Judges covers approximately between 1200 and 1150 B.C. And folks, the dating of the Judges is not something for amateurs or for someone with a weak heart. It takes a lot of study, a lot of speculation. You can read articles on that, but these dates are rough. They'll do. One of my commentators says the dates are, quote, historically unverifiable, like the dates of the kings are. So you just have to take your best shot. Now in verse 1, the sons of Israel inquired of the Lord, who's going to go up first against the Canaanites? How did they do that inquiry? John Gill says this, quote, the heads of them who gathered together at Shiloh, where the tabernacle was, and that's debatable, it could have been at Shechem, and standing before the high priest, either Eleazar, or rather Phinehas' son, as Eleazar being in all probability dead, they inquired by Urim and Thummim. That's that mysterious means of divine, I was about to say divine divination, that sounds sort of contradictory, but when people would inquire of the Lord, there was an Urim and Thummim wrapped in the breastplate of the high priest. I always like to think of it, a black stone, a white stone. We do, yes, the white stone, yes, the black stone's no. Shall Levi go up first? Black stone, no. Shall Zebulun go up first? Black stone, no. And they keep going through that until they come up with the right answer. And, of course, they have to trust God for the right answer. Now, they said, who's going to go up first? They had no commander-in-chief at this time. Remember, Joshua had not appointed a successor. But this was an inquiry as to which tribe, but not which individual leader, would go up first to whip up on the southern Canaanites. Now, of course, these Canaanites, seeing that Israel's leader was dead, Joshua was dead, they would no doubt start to make incursions. I have no doubt of that. Now, Judah was a logical choice to go first. It was the principal tribe. It was the most numerous. It was the most powerful. It was the most valiant. And in fact, it was predicted to be the preeminent tribe of Israel. In Genesis 49:8, this is Jacob giving his blessing on his sons, the 12 patriarchs, as he was dying. Jacob says this, quote, Judah, your brothers shall praise you. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. your father's son shall bow down to you. This is even though Judah is the fourth-born son of Leah, Jacob and Leah. But the top three had screwed themselves up through various sins, which we won't talk about. Jameson Foster and Brown says that Judah's predicted preeminence was thus conferred upon Judah by divine direction, whether it was by prophecy or by Urim and Thummim, which of course worked together because the same God was behind both. Now verse 2 says, the Lord said, Judah shall go up. I have given the land into his hand. Now what land is that? That's not the whole land of Israel. It's the part allotted to Judah in the book of Joshua. That part which was allotted to Judah and which Judah had not yet conquered. They had already conquered some of it. Remember, this conquering process was an ongoing process because even though Joshua had won the battles and there was rest in the land, there was basically three types of cities in Canaan land, in the Promised Land. One is cities occupied by Israelites. Two, cities occupied by Canaanites who were paying tribute to Israel. So therefore, they weren't military enemies. And then three, cities that were occupied by Canaanites but weren't paying tribute but did not have enough wherewithal to raise an army to attack the Israelites. Those, especially the last type, those are the ones that needed to be conquered. And so, because in that era, it was conquer or be conquered. They would come after Israel, and so it was time to go fight them. And so they chose Judah to go, and of course Simeon went too with Judah. Because in verse 3 we read, Judah said to Simeon, his brother, come up with me into the territory allotted me that we may fight against the Canaanites. And I in turn will go with you into the territory allotted you. So they made sort of a military pact here to go fight together. If you look at the map, you'll see that big territory of Judah all the way down from Jerusalem down to the southern border of Israel. And right in the middle of it is a circle, the territory of Simeon, which I think was sort of ill-defined. Their tribal inheritance was geographically contingent, so it made sense for them to go together, but also they were brothers. Of course, all 12 of the patriarchs were brothers, but some of them were half-brothers. But Simeon and Judah were brothers with the same mother, Leah, and the same father, Jacob. Simeon was Leah's second son, and Judah was the fourth son. I mentioned earlier what the first three sons had done to lose their preeminence in Israel. Simeon and Levi, when they first arrived in Shechem, remember, they had a sister, Dinah, and this guy, I think his name was Shechem, if I remember, fell in love with her and apparently went too far and raped her, whether it was a rape of love or whether a rape of brutality, I don't know, but at any rate, Simeon and Levi weren't happy about it, so they said, hey, we'll make a treaty with you, but you got to be circumcised to be in a treaty with us, and while they were healing from the circumcision, they went in and wiped them out. And so Jacob became smelly in the nostrils of the local Shechemites, and so he had to leave. So that's what knocked Simeon and Levi out. And then Reuben had sex with Jacob's concubine, Bilhah, which is pretty disgusting. So Judah ends up being on top. And in fact, if you look at the story of Israel in Egypt, it's Judah handling all the affairs between Joseph and Jacob. He's the one in charge of the clan now. So, but at any rate, Judah is now in charge, but Simeon has agreed to go with him, and they go out and ready to fight. We go now to Judges 1, verses 4 through 7. Judah went up, and the Lord gave the Canaanites and the Perizzites into their hands, and they defeated 10,000 men at Bezek. They found Adonibezek in Bezek and fought against him, and they defeated the Canaanites and the Perizzites. But Adonibezek fled, and they pursued him and caught him and cut off his thumbs and big toes. Adonibezek said, 70 kings with their thumbs and their big toes cut off used to gather up scraps under my table, as I have done, so God has repaid me. So they brought him to Jerusalem, and he died there. Now in verse 4, we see the term Canaanites. That can be a generic name for all the ites that are in the Promised Land, or it can be a specific tribe, the tribe of the Canaanites who were basically in present-day Lebanon, Phoenicia, the ancient Phoenicia on the coast, Mediterranean coast north of Israel. Here it's not the generic name, it's the specific Canaanites. They apparently had gotten down in the south somewhere. Same as the Perizzites. In fact, the Perizzites were usually said to be up in the northwest around Mount Carmel, but I saw one map where they were down here in the south, probably from this verse, because Judah is wiping them out down here in the south. 10,000 men of the Canaanites and Perizzites were beaten at Bezek. Bezek means lightning, according to Easton's dictionary. It was in the mountains not far from Jerusalem. Adonibezek, the king of Bezek, Adonai means Lord, and Bezek means lightning, so he's the Lord of lightning or the Lord of a place called Bezek. Adonibezek fled. When he got beat, he went all the way to Jerusalem. We'll see in just a little bit. He ends up in, well, actually, he didn't flee to Jerusalem. They brought him to Jerusalem after he was captured, after his thumbs and big toes were cut off. Why did the Israelites cut off his thumbs and toes? They cut off his thumbs and toes as they caught him fleeing. Adonibezek was probably trying to get to the fortified city of Jerusalem, which was very difficult for the Israelites to take. He didn't make it, got his thumbs and toes cut off. Why? Well, here's some options. One, perhaps the Israelites are trying to do justice to repay Adonibezek for what he had earlier done. And I don't know what he had earlier done. I'm sure he did some bad stuff. It's very reasonable to assume that he did some bad stuff to the tribe of Judah. Or it could be the Israelites, the tribe of Judah and Simeon were ignorant of what Adonibezek had done, but they just carried out justice through the providence of God, and that worked repentance in Adonibezek. John Gill says this is probably the case. The Israelites usually did not inflict such punishment, but here they did, and it caused Adonibezek to repent. Well, repent, that might be too strong a word. I would say he was definitely sorry for what he had done because he didn't have any thumbs and toes. And of course, the purpose of that is to keep him from fighting or running. That's in the Byzantine history of the Eastern Roman Empire. They were constantly blinding heir potential claimants to the throne because a blind person couldn't be an emperor. They could have just killed him, but they were trying to be a little charitable there. And remember, these are rough times. This does not mean God's very happy with all this. These are just a story of what, this is a historical account of what people did back then. Doesn't mean he approved of it or would approve of it today, and certainly not in the church. That would be ridiculous. Well, anyway, in verse 7, Adonibezek says, "Oh, I have been repaid for all this bad stuff I've done." His hardened conscience apparently was finally touched. But it's hard to know this for certain. Did he really repent before God? Well, the word God there is Elohim, which is gods. So he could have been said, "Well, the gods have repaid me." It's like pagans today say, "Oh, the baseball gods were against me. My team lost." You know, that doesn't mean they repented. So I don't know what we can gather from this. Adonibezek said 70 kings used to eat under his table, used to gather around his tables. These couldn't be kings. They may be kinglets, chieftains, military officers, not really kings in the proper sense. That's a translation issue. Gather around my table. Adam Clark says that's a proverbial expression to say that these kings were under Adonibezek's jurisdiction, his protection, sort of like a vassal in the Middle Ages. Not that they literally sat around and ate around Adonibezek's table, and I think that probably makes a lot of sense. Jameson Fawcett Brown believes that it's actually literal. A great number of 70 kings will not appear strange when it is considered that anciently every ruler of a city or large town was called a king. So he says 70 leaders from 70 cities came and gathered around and banqueted with Adonibezek. I don't know, but apparently he was a big shot, and Israel took care of him. So now we go to Judges chapter 1, verses 8 through 10. Then the sons of Judah fought against Jerusalem and captured it and struck it with the edge of the sword and set the city on fire. Afterward, the sons of Judah went down to fight against the Canaanites living in the hill country and in the Negev and in the lowland. So Judah went against the Canaanites who lived in Hebron. Now the name of Hebron formerly was Kiriath Arba. And they struck Sheshai, Ahiman, and Talmai. Now we see here in verse 8 a problem of when did this happen? Because all of what we're going to see here, especially with the taking of Hebron, already occurred in the book of Joshua. And as Ellicott has said in his introduction, he says that, I don't know if he says all of or most of the first chapter of Judges is a rehash of what happened in Joshua. And I think he's probably right. All right, first of all, in chapter 8, we see Jerusalem has been captured. Now, here's the problem here. Jerusalem has already been captured in Joshua 15:63. Now, as for the Jebusites, the inhabitants of Jerusalem, the sons of Judah could not drive them out, so the Jebusites live with the sons of Judah at Jerusalem until this day. Well, that means that the Judahites, they didn't totally run out the Jebusites, but they managed to live with them in Jerusalem, so they got part of the city, apparently. It's clear that the earlier Jerusalem in Joshua was inhabited at least in part by Israelites. Now, how did this happen? How is it that they are there, and now they're fighting again here in Judges 1, 8, and 10. Well, the easiest way to answer that is to say that Judges 1, verses 8 through 10 is a rehash of what happened in Joshua 15:63. Another way you could reconcile it is to say that, no, here in Judges 1:8, this is talking about taking Jerusalem again. It was taken partially by the Israelites back in Joshua 15:63, and then the Israelites had to come in again and capture it and set it on fire. And, of course, setting it on fire would not be the part that they had already captured, but would be the Jebusite quarter of the city that they set on fire. They wouldn't burn their own portion of the city down. Now, that's reasonable, and that they had to go in and take it twice. I say it's reasonable because in verse 8 it says, "Then the sons of Judah fought against Israel." It just sounds like it was chronologically after they had decided at Shiloh to go out and capture and fight against the Canaanites and Perizzites, and then they fought against Jerusalem and went after the Jebusites. That makes sense. Verse 9 says, "Afterward, the sons of Judah," and I'm assuming this is after this, assuming there was two attacks on Jerusalem. This is the second attack. Verse 9, afterward, the sons of Judah went down to fight against the Canaanites living in the hill country and in the Negev and in the lowland. They went down because Jerusalem's high up in the air. It's basically on a mountainous plateau. They went down to fight against the Canaanites living in the hill country. That's the ridge of hills that runs straight up the center of the promised land, all the way from south of Jerusalem, all the way up to the northern border. The Negev is, after those, as you go south from Jerusalem, the hills flatten out, and pretty soon you got desert everywhere down there, all the way down to Egypt, all the way down to the Gulf of Aqaba, all the way down to the Sinai Peninsula. That's the Negev. And in the lowland, that's the NASB translates it as lowland. The Holman Christian Study Bible translates it as the Judean foothills. And then they've got a note that says the Shephelah. I prefer the Shephelah. That's the flat area that's on the Mediterranean coast that runs up to the hill country in the center of the Promised Land. And so basically, Judah went down to fight them all. In the Negev, because they were in charge of the south, the Judahites were, and also in the hill country there, that's the southern hill country, and the Shephelah on the plains. As we'll see, the Shephelah had these cities that later became Philistine cities. Now, in verse 10, we have Judah going against the Canaanites who lived in Hebron. Now, here's where we have a problem. It doesn't say afterwards. It just says, so Judah went against. And, you know, if you translate that as so Judah had gone against, then you refer it back to the past, which I'm sure is where it happened. It has to be. So Judah went against the Canaanites who lived in Hebron, and the name of Hebron formerly was Kiriath Arba, and they struck Sheshai and Ahiman and Talmai. And that was Caleb's doing. Caleb would be so old now, he wouldn't be doing it now. So this is a rehash. Again, this makes sense because it's just saying, hey, just like the Judahites took Hebron in the past, now we're taking them here in the present as we fight in the hill country, the negative, and the lowland. And by the way, before I go to Hebron, let's go back to Jerusalem real quick. I need to point out that Jerusalem was finally conquered totally by David. Now, David, of course, is 1010 to 970 B.C., a good while after this. Judges happened between about 1200 and 1150, and David is 1010. So you're talking about at least 100 years, 150 years later, they finally got Jerusalem totally conquered. We can read about David driving out the Jebusites in 2 Samuel 5, 6 through 9. To save time, I won't read that to you. Now, we go to Hebron in verse 10, the conquering of Hebron. We assume that this has happened back in the time of Joshua, Joshua 15:12. The west border was at the Great Sea, even its coastline. This is the border around the sons of Judah, according to their family. So that's the west end of the west boundary of Judah. Joshua 15:14, Caleb drove out from there the three sons of Anak, Sheshai, and Ahiman, and Talmai, the same three that are mentioned here in Judges chapter 1, verse 10. So that's why I think it's talking about an earlier event. Gill and Clark agree with that. They say this is a repetition of what was recorded in Joshua. Now, you could take it the other way and say the recording in Joshua is an anticipation of what happened in Judges, but I don't think so because Caleb would be so old, hard for me to believe that he would actually do that. Or you could say there were two expeditions against Hebron, but the problem with that is it just sounds exactly like the same expedition, and you got the same three people killed. Joshua 15:14, Caleb drove out from there the three sons of Anak, Sheshai, and Ahiman, and Talmai, the children of Anak. Well, I mean, that's exactly what's being said here in Judges, so I assume that this is just a rehash of what happened in Joshua. And the story involves Caleb giving his daughter as a wife to somebody. Well, by the time here in Judges, Caleb would be too old to have a daughter of marriageable age. Let's read the capture of Hebron by Caleb in Joshua 15, verses 15 through 19. Then he went up from there, that's Caleb, against the inhabitants of Debir. Now the name of Debir formerly was Kiriath Sefer. Debir was a little bit south on the road down from Hebron. And Caleb said, "The one who attacks Kiriath Sefer and captures it, I will give him Achsah, my daughter, as a wife." Othniel, the son of Kenaz, the brother of Caleb, captured it, so he gave him Achsah, his daughter, as a wife. It came about that when she came to him, she persuaded him to ask her father for a field. So she alighted from the donkey, and Caleb said to her, "What do you want?" Then she said, "Give me a blessing, since you have given me the land of the Negev. Give me also springs of water." So he gave her the upper springs and the lower springs. And we talked about that in Joshua 15 when we were there. And by the way, verse 17 says, in Joshua 15 says, Othniel, the son of Kenaz, the brother of Caleb, captured it. And he, that's Othniel. If you say Othniel is the brother of Caleb, that means Othniel is marrying Caleb's daughter Achsah, Othniel's niece, which violates the Levitical laws of consanguinity. So we have to read this as Othniel, the son of Kenaz. Kenaz is the brother of Caleb. And so Othniel is not the brother of Caleb, but Kenaz is the brother of Caleb. So Caleb had a brother named Kenaz. Kenaz had a son named Othniel. Caleb had a daughter named Achsah. So Othniel and Achsah are first cousins, and that's perfectly okay according to the laws of Leviticus. I'm sure that is TMI, but I just felt like talking about it. All right, we now go to Judges chapter 1, verses 11 through 15. Then from there, he, that's Caleb, went against the inhabitants of Debir. Now the name of Debir formerly was Kiriath Sefer. Now you're going to notice I just read you the story in Joshua. Now here it is in Judges, and it's exactly the same thing. Caleb said, "The one who attacks Kiriath Sefer and captured it, I will even give him my daughter Achsah for a wife." Othniel, the son of Kenaz, Caleb's other brother, captured it, so he gave him his daughter Achsah for a wife. Then it came about when she came to him that she persuaded him to ask her father for a field. Then she alighted from her donkey. And Caleb said to her, "What do you want?" She said to him, "Give me a blessing, since you have given me the land of the Negev. Give me also springs of water." So Caleb gave her the upper springs and the lower springs. I'm sure that's the upper springs and lower springs somewhere around Hebron. So you see, it's the exact same story. So that's why we know this is a rehash of what happened, at least in my opinion, it's a rehash of what happened in Joshua 15. Debir is called Kiriath Sefer. And, of course, Caleb fought against those guys. Kiriath Sefer means the city of books, right south of Hebron. Easton says, "The name of this town is an evidence that the Canaanites were acquainted with writing and books. The town probably contained a noted school or was the site of an oracle and the residence of some learned priest. The books were probably engraved stones or bricks." It's kind of interesting. Now, Achsah marrying into Caleb's family to be married into the chief Achsah was the daughter. Othniel was married to Achsah. To be married into the chief priest of the tribe of Judah was a very great honor. And to boot, John Gill says, Othniel's getting a large dowry coming to him, Gill calls it a dowry. I think technical legal term is a curtsy, but we won't quibble over that. The point is, this was an advantageous marriage. So we go now to Judges 1, verse 16. The descendants of the Kenite, Moses' father-in-law, went up from the city of Palms with the sons of Judah to the wilderness of Judah, which is in the south of Arad, and they went and lived with the people. Now, the first thing you might ask is, what in the world are the descendants of Moses' father-in-law, the Kenite, what in the world were they doing first in the city of Palms, Jericho, and then wandering on down into the Negev, down to the south, where Arad was? What were they there for? Well, let's see how that happened. The Kenite, of course, is referring to Jethro, who was Moses' father-in-law. Jethro, remember, had a daughter named Zipporah, and Zipporah married Moses. So Jethro's son, Hobab, that's Zipporah's brother, he went with the Israelites on the Exodus. I don't have the site here. Yes, I do. Numbers 10, verse 29. Then Moses said to Hobab, the son of Reuel, the Midianite. Reuel's another name for Jethro. He had two names. Moses said to Hobab, "We are setting out to the place of which the Lord said, I will give it to you." That's the promised land. "Come with us, and we will do you good, for the Lord has promised good concerning Israel." And Hobab took Moses up on that offer, and he went. And he was there with Joshua as they crossed the Jordan River. And after that first victory at Jericho, apparently they were camped around Jericho. And then they decided to move on down to the south at Arad. Arad's mentioned in Numbers, Joshua, 1 Samuel a couple times. Easton says that Arad is a Canaanite city about 20 miles south of Hebron. So it's down there in the Negev. And Moses' in-laws went down there, the Kenites. And Jethro's a Kenite. Now, it's interesting here that Arad, the king of Arad, fought against Israel and took of them prisoners, according to Easton's, when the Israelites were retreating from the confines of Edom. Remember, they tried to attack after they had repented of not listening to Joshua and Caleb to go in and take the promised land. They listened to the bad report of the evil spies, and God said, you better retreat, go back down to the Red Sea, to the Gulf of Aqaba. They didn't do it. Well, they attacked, they got clobbered, and then they retreated from the confines of Edom. And at that time of their retreating, the king of Arad fought against Israel and took some of them prisoners. Well, so here's a little poetic justice here. They won the initial victory, but Israel ended up winning the battle. Adam Clark says this, after the conquest of that country, Arad, the Kenites established themselves there and remained in it till the days of Saul, mingled with the Amalekites. When this king, Saul, received a commandment from God to destroy the Amalekites, he sent a message to the Kenites to depart from among them, as God would not destroy them with the Amalekites. The Amalekites were bad dudes. They fought Israel all the way back at the first year of the Exodus, or in the second year of the Exodus, at Rephidim. I think it was the first year of the Exodus, at Rephidim, near Mount Sinai, and God's had it in for the Amalekites to judge them for centuries, but the Kenites he protected, even though they lived with the Amalekites. Good application point there. If you're living with a bunch of pagans that God is going to judge, i.e. if you're an American Christian, that doesn't mean you're going to get judged too, just because you're an American, just because you live in the same geographical city. I hope that's an apropos application. We go now to verses 17 through 19 of Judges 1. Then Judah went with Simeon his brother, and they struck the Canaanites living in Zephath. And utterly destroyed it. So the name of the city was called Hormah. Hormah means destruction. And Judah took Gaza with its territory, and Ashkelon with its territory, and Ekron with its territory. Now the Lord was with Judah, and they took possession of the hill country, but they could not drive out the inhabitants of the valley. The valley there is the Shephelah, the lowlands going down toward the coast, because they had iron chariots. All right, let's look at Zephath here. I'm looking at, well, Zephath is also called Hormah. It was originally called Zephath. My BibleAtlas.org map has a question mark by Hormah, but Hormah is, we just talked about Arad, which is way down 20 miles south of Hebron, and now going southwest another 10 miles or so on the same brook that runs through Beersheba. So we're really getting down here into the Negev now is Hormah. Now, Zephath, its original name means beacon or watchtower. I mentioned just a minute ago that Arad fought against Israel. Numbers 21:1. Let me read that. When the Canaanite king of Arad, they fought against Israel when Israel was on the Exodus, right in the second year. Then they were repulsed there at Kadesh Barnea, and then they retreated all the way back to the Red Sea. I'm assuming that that's a different incident than here in Judges 1. I could be wrong. In fact, Clark says I'm wrong. He says that it's the same transaction. It's a repeat, a rehash. Again, all this is questionable. Numbers 21:1, when the Canaanite king of Arad, who lived in the Negev, heard that Israel was coming on the Atharim road, he fought against Israel and captured some prisoners. Well, I don't see why it can't be a separate incident there. They fought them twice. They got beat the first time and won the second. And then in verse 18, Judah took Gaza, Ashkelon, and Ekron. Those are famous because they're three of the famous five Philistine cities down there on the southwest coast of Israel, or at least southwest portion, the Shephelah of Israel. Gaza is at the extreme southwest on the coast, still there today, you know, the Gaza Strip. Ashkelon is a little bit further up in the north. There's a big oil pipe that goes right across the Negev, right into Ashkelon from the tip of the Gulf of Aqaba in order to get oil from, I don't know where they get oil from, but it ends up at Ashkelon and then shipped out to all the other countries in Europe. Ekron is a little bit further inland, but still there in that same general area. Ashkelon is north of Gaza on the coast and south of the third future Philistine city of Ashdod on the coast. Now, these cities, of course, were captured by the Philistines a little bit later. The Philistines, I think, came in around 1300, 1200. Again, those dates are fuzzy, and we are now in the 1300s. So Judah captured these cities, but it didn't last long. The Philistines ended up taking them back. Now, Ekron, by lot, had fallen to Judah, but later it was given to Dan. So Judah got the city of Ekron. It was later given to Dan, and then the Philistines ended up with it anyway. Joshua 15:45, Ekron with its towns and villages. That's in a list of Judah's cities. And then in Joshua 19:43, referring to Dan's inheritance, Elon, Timnah, and Ekron. But it's, as I said, in a short time, all three cities were retaken by the Philistines, and they had them together. And I think they finally didn't lose them until the Assyrians came in around 700 B.C. or so and wiped out the area, wiped out the Philistines. Ekron was a few miles north of Gath, by the way, where Goliath was from. Now, Gaza by lot had fallen to the tribe of Judah. We see this in Joshua 15:47. Ashdod with its towns and villages, Gaza with its towns and villages. And, of course, that's referring to Judah's allotment. Now, in verse 19, it said that Judah couldn't wipe out the aboriginal pagans there in the Shephelah in the lowland. Why not? Were they afraid? Were the Judahites slothful? Were they weary of fighting? Clark speculates that maybe they had fallen into some sin which called forth God's displeasure and God was no longer fighting for them. And Clark continues, quote, strange were the iron chariots too strong for omnipotence. And, of course, omnipotence is capitalized. Well, you know, you can always complain about people not doing something, but God often uses natural means. And a lot of times he says, hey, you need to retreat here. He's not going to do a miracle for you. Natural processes are going to follow on. So I think that Adam Clark is being a little bit strict here. And this is in the valley. The NASB has it translated. Cal and Dillich say the valley is the Shephelah, the lowlands. The Holman Christian Study Bible has the Judean foothills, or the Shephelah. The point is that the land is low and flat, and chariots fight very well in that type of terrain, and that's why the sons of Judah couldn't wipe them out. But they did get the cities, because chariots can't fight in a city. Now we go to Judges chapter 1, verse 20. Judah gave Hebron to Caleb, just as Moses had promised. Then Caleb drove out the three sons of Anak who lived there. Now I'm assuming this is referring to the previous capture of Hebron by Caleb in the times of Joshua, recorded in Joshua 14 and Joshua 21. I've already gone over that. Caleb drove out the three sons of Anak. Of course, that's Sheshai, Ahiman, and Talmai. By the way, Kiriath Arba was the former name of Hebron. Some people say that Kiriath means city, and Arba means a king named Arba, so the city of Arba the king. Some people say Arba means four, and so that Kiriath Arba is the city of the four giants, Anak and his three sons, Sheshai, Ahiman, and Talmai. A little factoid there for you to chew on. Ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished with the conquering of the sons of Judah, the conquest done by the sons of Judah. That prepares us for the last part of Judges chapter 1, verses 21 through 36, which I will entitle Failure to Drive Out the Canaanites. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.